Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Today's guests are doctors on the front lines who see the health effects of climate change, pollution, and the reduction of biodiversity. In their new book, Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health, doctors Jay Lemery and Paul Auerbach argue that we need to start paying attention to how climate change is putting our health in danger. Climate change is expected to impact human health by worsening pre-existing problems in people, thereby acting as a threat multiplier. And we already have so much data on this issue. Over the past two decades, weather-related disasters have killed more than 600,000 people. And by the year 2100, sea level rise will force the displacement of up to 50 million people. So what should we do about this? And what will it take to spend more time focusing on this issue? Dr. Jay Lemery is Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and Chief of the Section of Wilderness and Environmental Medicine. Hi, Dr. Lemery. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Dr. Paul Auerbach, the Regelet Family Professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and founder and past president of the Wilderness Medical Society. Hi, Dr. Auerbach. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good morning. So you both came up with this term, enviromedics. Dr. Auerbach, where did this term come from? How did you come up with it?
I really need to credit Jay for that. He was the brilliance behind the term and saw that we needed something that would be an intersection between the medical profession and the environment. So all credit to Jay for the terminology.
Dr. Lemery, how did you come up with this term, enviromedics?
I think we were on a trip, and I was with some friends, and we were actually talking about how we needed a new moniker to kind of attract attention to this problem, and that there wasn't anything that it wasn't any one word that one could come up with. And so I think we thought about environment, medicine, and then we just sort of blended into a word, and enviromedics, and then it just sort of sat there for a while. And then, you know, I was inspired by Paul's brilliant essay that he wrote in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, in 2008, called Physicians and the Environment. And then I called him up immediately. I was like, we got to do something. And then I think enviromedics popped in there, unrelated, and then it sort of became the phrase for this this idea that we had and have moved forward.
Talk about your main argument in the book. I mean, you write about the science. You say that that's obviously so important. What's happening to the planet is so important. But what is not getting that much attention is how climate change will affect human health. And it seems like you're sort of putting a call out to, you know, everyone from the media to the health profession that we need to spend more time on this issue. Would you say that's right, Dr. Lemery?
Yeah, that's an issue of risk assessment. I mean, we saw that, you know, we know sickness, and this is sickness, and that's really what Paul and I have been talking about, and that we realized that there was a conspicuous absence of the clinical community on this. And so when we thought about this, we said, you know, let's take the reader to the bedside, and instead of, you know, a lot of the statistics out there, they're public health statistics, very meaningful but hard to get your hands around. You talk about hundreds of thousands of people affected by this. It's most people, it's difficult to relate. So we said, let's take people to the bedside and talk about what we know we'll be seeing a lot more of based on the drivers of climate change, how it affects health, and really, you know, flesh out these clinical vignettes, which we had in the book, which talk about, you know, degraded air mass from wildfires. How does that translate into asthma attacks, and what does that really feel like? And I think that was, you know, our effort to advance science communication on this topic.
Dr. Auerbach, what would you add to that?
I think Jay has hit the nail on the head, and I would add that there are a lot of analogies to this effort. If we look at some of the major initiatives to improve health in the general population, for instance, limiting tobacco use and eliminating cigarette smoking, et cetera, there's been a natural evolution where there's been in medical, even medical opposition to some of that. Doctors used to smoke, but mostly the industrial complex and political complex. And to bring that to the fore, we wanted to engage healthcare professionals and then realize this is a huge topic that is much broader than just medical professionals. It affects everybody. It knows no boundaries. It knows no preference for anyone, with the exception that people that are disadvantaged socioeconomically are disproportionately affected by this for a variety of reasons. So this is a call to action, really. And the other thing I would add is we're staying within our boundaries. We're leaving climate science to the climate scientists. We've done our own analysis of that and concluded that we believe that there is global warming and climate change, and we want everybody to realize how that will impact their lives directly.
Paul, you both are on the front lines. You see the health effects of climate change and pollution and so many other things today, and it's just going to get worse based on the science that we have. What concerns you the most right now? What do you think people don't know about?
I think people don't translate issues like this into a personal situation. But what I'm really most worried about is the sociology and the psychology of getting people engaged in understanding the issue and moving forward, because there's a very fine line between people becoming actually depressed over the situation and saying there's nothing I can do and becoming inert, and becoming inspired about it and seeing how they can learn more and do something. So while the book points out some really bad things that could be close to inevitable if we don't make some changes, we don't want people to be morose about it. We want them to be inspired about it and try and do something.
Jay, what would you add?
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea that, you know, we're trying to flip the switch. I mean, and change. I think the real issue is that it was risk assessment. I think people don't get it. They don't feel empowered to be able to make a change in this. And so what we wanted to do is put forth the best science and give where it really hits home, you know, when you think about the health of your loved ones or, you know, your children. That's if that's not a fulcrum for action, you know, what is? So that's what we wanted to do. And then, you know, in the end, we finished the book by saying, you know, here's some tangible things one can do. And then we have this afterword where we had young people chime in because we felt it was really important for the next generation to have a voice. And they're absolutely optimistic and empowered and they're doing great work. And we thought that was a really important way to end the book, because it's not about doom and gloom. Ultimately, there's plenty of opportunity to change the business as usual, as we say.
We're already dealing with this. I mean, we just had the horrific North Bay fires, and my family lives up in the North Bay, and I'll never forget waking up that morning. My mom sent me a text saying, everyone's okay. And at that point, I had no idea what was happening. But the smoke in my San Francisco apartment was so thick. And, you know, we're about an hour away from Petaluma. One of our guests that we had on last week, who lives in Berkeley, had to cancel our show because his throat was still hurting him. He had a really tough time breathing and coughing, and he was about an hour away from the fires. And this was 3 weeks later. So, Paul, I mean, this is already happening right now. So many people were wearing masks. We were, you know, looking at the level of just what the air quality was like in the Bay Area, whether it was red or yellow or green. And you both write about this, and you say that this could become a daily occurrence in our lives.
Well, there are a couple points to emphasize on this, and that is that this is a problem without boundaries and borders. The air connects around the world. The water connects around the world. Energy resources connect around the world. So you can't partition this off region by region. So in the Bay Area, when we had fires in the North Bay, the smoke drifted down and covered an enormous area. And that is a very, very important point to make. When the statistics come out later on, when people study the North Bay fires, as they have studied other adverse weather and meteorological events, They'll find that emergency department visits were up. They'll find that chronic diseases like asthma were worsened, and that more people got sick. So there's no question that this is a problem that is present. And everything connects to everything. Why did this happen? It's very hard to pin, or sometimes hard to pin, specific events to climate change. So people asked me, what were these fires due to climate change? Well, in a way they were, because the fire season in Northern California has been estimated to be 80 days longer because of the heat and lack of humidity, and that can be very directly attributed to climate change.
What would you add, Jay?
Yeah, I mean, it's this concept of threat multiplier, right? And I think, you know, causality is difficult to prove, although we're seeing more of it. But we know this will make bad things worse. And the concept of threat multiplier, whether it's food security, you know, wildfires, extreme weather events, this is a driver, right? Climate change is a driver. We're energizing our environment by that, you know, makes things more unpredictable. It's not just a warmer planet, it's a more unpredictable, hyper-energized planet.
We know now that extreme heat is the leading cause of weather-related deaths in the United States. Over the past two decades, weather-related disasters have killed more than 600,000 people. And as you said in your book, you have stories about what has already been happening. Can you talk a little bit about DAISY? In the section Heat Waves and Heat Stress, there's another section called Too Hot, and you write that Philadelphia can be intolerably hot and humid in the summer. Muggy means more like getting mugged by the heat. If you walk down Broad Street near Temple University and watch the shimmering waves of hot air rise from the pavement, step over the bubbles of sticky asphalt, or the bottom of your shoes will turn black and nasty. And you write that Daisy's apartment was right across the street from the hospital, but she was too old and proud to leave her cramped, stifling quarters and make her way to sit in the air-conditioned lobby. Tell us a little bit about Daisy and what happened to her. Do you want to start that one off, Paul?
Yeah, I'll take credit for that one. And names and gender were changed to protect the innocent. That happened in a very similar form, and I vividly remember caring for an elder person who encountered just that situation. And elders are at increased risk for lots of medical problems, but particularly environmental problems, because they can't fend for themselves so well. And Jay and I are both emergency physicians, and I've worked side by side with Jay. And we love to take care of people, but it sometimes breaks our heart to have to do it. And there'll always be enough people for us to take care of. We're not worried about that. We really are into injury prevention. And so what we need to glean from stories like Daisy's is the ability to predict what can happen and try and make interventions to try and keep people healthy and whole. And some of that is one-on-one, and some of that is system-wide, and climate change is a system-wide issue that we just have to address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Jay, we hear about these statistics, but we rarely hear about what happens to specific individuals unless it happens in your hometown, and your hometown paper might cover it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that's it. That's where we really have filled a niche, is that, you know, we're clinicians at the bedside. But as emergency physicians, we're doctors for the vulnerable, right? And we see the most vulnerable people that don't have access to care or can't get, you know, that don't have the socioeconomic means, have multiple comorbidities. I mean, these are the people that show up in the emergency department. Climate change is a disease of vulnerability, right? It's the most vulnerable, whether socioeconomic, you know, extremes of age, medical comorbidities. These are the people who will be bearing the brunt, those that have resources, and this includes populations too. So, you know, throughout the world, it's the places with poor governance, tenuous food supplies, poverty, who are just going to have no resiliency when these global effects, you know, begin to accelerate. and have accelerated.
There's a couple things to talk about when we're talking about extreme heat. We just had a heat wave in the Bay Area, and the Press Democrat and others report that six people may have died, six people who are older. Paul, do you think that the medical system is prepared for this?
I think, yeah, till we start to see huge numbers, the medical system is prepared. So the emergency departments and hospitals don't get overwhelmed until we have a mass casualty situation. And that would be something like an earthquake or a wildfire that affects dozens or hundreds of people, or a tsunami, et cetera. But the bigger issue is that for people to only report six deaths is likely a big underestimate because of what Jay said and what we know to be true, which is the threat multiplier. That may have been six people who died because they were diagnosed with frank heat stroke or heat illness and were reported. But that doesn't take into account the many, many, many more people who had chronic heart disease or chronic lung disease or chronic kidney disease who were weak to start with and couldn't tolerate that heat burden and therefore succumbed to their basic illness as opposed to the heat itself. So heat was the threat multiplier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the studies we cite in our book is from the Harvard School of Public Health, which says for every 1 degree increase in centigrade for heat, the death rate for people with comorbidities, so congestive heart failure, diabetes, is anywhere between 2.5 to 4% increase. And, you know, these people come into the hospitals, they're treated for congestive heart failure and diabetes exacerbations. And that's how we code the charts, right? And that might be right and appropriate from a medical coding point of view. But what you often don't know unless you do dig deeper is that, oh, by the way, of all the days of the year that that exacerbation occurred, it happened to be during the extreme heat wave.
And you report that by 2100, there will be 100 million people alive over the age of 65 years old. But, I mean, we can look at what we're dealing with today, where we've got, it's 10,000 people in the United States turn 65 every single day. I mean, the baby boomer generation is aging. And so this is going to become a really important issue. And, Paul, I mean, this just speaks to why we need, I mean, I don't know how you both feel about universal health care, but we do a lot of shows about health care, and people are going to need care because they're going to be dealing with this, these issues in the coming years.
Well, there's no question that people need care. You know, the precise venue of that, whether it's the current healthcare system or national healthcare system, will be determined by politicians and analysis of systems, but there's no question that as the population ages, and I'm one of them, they have more significant diseases, more significant problems, and require more health care. But while it'll be the old that are and the very young and the infirm and the socioeconomically disadvantaged that are disproportionately affected, The healthiest, brightest, and most vibrant young people in our population need to pick up the flag and need to challenge what's going on with the environment now, because while they may be young and healthy and feeling great now, 60 years from now, they'll be facing an entirely different environmental situation and personal situation as well.
And you both point out that laborers will really feel the effects of this because they have no choice but to work outside in the heat. On today's Your Call, it's our One Planet series, and we're speaking with Dr. Paul Auerbach, family professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine and founder and past president of the Wilderness Medical Society. We're also joined by Dr. Jay Lemery, associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and and chief of the Section of Wilderness and Environmental Medicine. Jay and Paul are both emergency physicians, and they are on the front lines. They are seeing the health effects of climate change on a regular basis, and their main argument is that we need to spend more time focusing on this issue. If you have any questions or comments for Dr. Jay Lemery and Dr. Paul Auerbach, we'd love to hear from you. If you were affected by the fires recently, if you find that you have more asthma, a lot of friends are talking about how asthma is just affecting them more and more these days. In fact, we have a comment on our Facebook page, which I will find in just a minute, from Joe, who says, a lot more allergies for me. I've also wondered with the increase in mosquitoes if we're going to see blooms of mosquito-borne illnesses. So if you have any questions or comments, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. So what about that, Jay? A lot of people are saying they're experiencing more allergies and longer allergies seasons.
Yeah, I mean, right, the pollen counts are going up. Pollen, you know, growing seasons are much longer, particularly in the northern areas. And, you know, there's some data to say that the types of plants that are thriving are some of the nastiest, you know, ragweed that promote aeroallergens. So this is all part of it. You know, we're altering our ecosystems in ways we're just understanding from this. And, you know, the increase in our aeroallergens and, you know, hay fever and rhinorrhea, you know, these you know, sneezy-type diseases, which, you know, few people die from it, but if you've ever had it, you know, it's incapacitating and can make you miserable. So we think it's a pretty significant thing to talk about.
Paul, what can people do about this?
The avoidance is the key, but there's some things you just can't change. So let's say that that allergens increase, intensify, and spread. We can't put a big air filter over the planet. People talk about bioengineering the planet to try and change some of these, but no one's come up with a way to totally filter the air. So if you are susceptible to allergies, and allergy season gets longer and more diffuse, and you're therefore more prone to be ill more often and perhaps with greater intensity, then really the only choice you have is avoidance, which would mean putting people into the indoors and not being outdoors, and or having to take more medications, have more desensitization programs, treat it medically. There's no way around it.
And in the book Enviromedics, we learn that in the United States alone, an estimated 50 million people suffer from bronchitis, asthma, or one of many other allergic conditions. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Jay Lemery and Dr. Paul Auerbach about their new book, Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. They say that we need to start paying more attention to how climate change is putting our health in danger. Our guests are emergency physicians, and they're on the front lines who see the health effects of climate change, pollution, and the reduction of biodiversity. And as the climate change conference in Bonn, Germany continues, we decided that we wanted to focus on an issue that really does deserve a lot more attention. We're talking about public health. In the book Enviromedics, they write that the air quality in many other countries is much grimmer. In China, air pollution is felt to be a major threat to public health. Scientists are calling for urgent action to reduce pollution. In the UK, it's estimated that air pollution arising from burning fossil fuels accounts for 40,000 premature deaths annually. And coming up after the break, we'll continue to talk about pollution. A number of new studies are coming out about how many people around the globe die from pollution every year. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Mark Bray about his new book, Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Wednesday, Noam Cohen will join us to talk about the know-it-alls, the rise of Silicon Valley as a political powerhouse and social wrecking ball. And then Thursday, MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell will be in studio to talk about his new book, Playing with Fire, the 1968 Election and the Transformation of American Politics. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are talking about climate change and its effect on human health. We're speaking with Dr. Jay Lemery and Dr. Paul Auerbach about their new book, Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. They are both emergency physicians. They're on the front lines, and they see what's happening with pollution, the reduction of biodiversity, people coming in from heat exposure. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk a little bit more about pollution, because in the last 2 weeks, there have been so many stories about how air pollution is killing people around the globe. And a new study by the Yale School of Public Health, and you also write about this in your book, looks at how air pollution actually contributes to higher levels of depression. Paul, can you talk a little bit about how this not only affects our health, but really our overall well-being?
No question about it. The overall concept of climate change and the bad effects that it's having makes some people just depressed in general, as do other big sociologic and economic interests. If you change your lifestyle, if you're forced to change your lifestyle, or you are limited, or you're sick more often, your mental health follows your physical health. No question about it. So the whole subject matter, as well as the direct effects, affect people in a bad way. And you're absolutely right that over the last couple weeks, there's been a tremendous number of stories. In India, I believe in Delhi, the pollution was so bad that people really couldn't even go outside. Just think about that. Mm. Think about how you would feel if you literally couldn't go outside because the air was so bad and there was nothing that you could do about it. That's depressing.
Very depressing. And also, Jay, the data also shows us that it reduces happiness, which obviously is connected to depression. But there's just major psychological costs of air pollution that we don't really talk about.
Yeah, I mean, you can't go outside and recreate. You think about if going outside becomes hazardous to your health, there's just so much downstream, impact from that. And I think, it's dangerous to your health, but also there's the mental health toll of that, when you think about how it's a very difficult problem to get one's hands around, and, the ability for one person to change it can feel extremely overwhelming. And, we knew that leads to dysphoria and depression as well.
Well, I appreciated that when you wrote about specific people in your book, you wrote about the trauma that they deal with after a fire, for example. I mean, so many people who lost everything in the North Bay fires are dealing with so much trauma right now. The same goes for hurricanes, what we're seeing in Puerto Rico. I was reading about Hurricane Sandy and how people are still struggling to figure out what they're going to do with their lives. I mean, this is a major mental health issue also, Paul.
It ranks up there with everything else that currently causes people in around the world to have anxiety and, in some cases, depression. Whether it's active shooter situations, whether it's the threat of nuclear war, whether it's food and water insecurity, whether it's global warming, environmental change. These are big issues, and people either directly or subliminally take them to heart, and it can be very depressing.
How would you like to see public officials actually deal with this issue? Paul?
That's a pretty obvious answer, I think. I first thing I'd like to see them do is put the best science. Are you still there?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The first thing I'd like to see them do is put the best scientists around them that they possibly can, because that is just so important, so that they're working off balanced and appropriate data. I'd like to see more public science forums in which these issues are discussed, And, of course, we believe that climate change is real, and so we would like to see that addressed proactively in a phenomenon that recognizes that there are changes that have already occurred that can't be undone, and we have to take action before we make changes that will be very bad and that will not be undone. So I'd like to see our political system and our industrial complex get behind this issue in a way that mitigates the climate change. I just can't see any downside to studying it appropriately and to making the changes that will make the people on the planet healthier.
You know, I have to ask these questions because of what we're currently dealing with. Climate deniers running the government. There are a number of articles about the administration erasing the word climate change from government websites. I mean, you have Scott Pruitt blowing up the EPA. I don't know if you both saw a testimony recently from Kathleen Harnett White, who's been tapped to be the senior environmental advisor. It was shocking, really. She spoke to a Senate committee last Wednesday and really had no idea what she was talking about. I mean, the senators were shocked. So given these realities, Jay, I mean, you're both on the front lines. We know what we need to do in many cases, but you're really up against a wall with this administration.
It's clear that a lot of the science is being politicized. So I echo Paul. Like, we have to get science back to informing our decisions. You know, we understand that there's people whose jobs and livelihoods and economies are tied up in different energy sources. That's not what this is about. This is about understanding the best science so we can all have an accurate risk assessment, and then we can go back to our own constituencies, whether they be red or blue, and make good policy changes, but we're informed. And that hasn't happened. You know, right now, I think half of America doesn't even think that this is our own fault, right? So when half the people in the room don't think there's a problem, you've got no chance at a solution. And I think that's what we're trying to tackle, is changing that risk assessment so people can have. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Jay. If I take us back to first principles, so we both came from and come from an emergency medicine and a wilderness medicine background. And when we first were contemplating this, one of the motivators was, we said, well, you know, if there's no wilderness, it's going to be hard to have wilderness medicine. So that was one of the issues that drove us, which was purely preservation of the planet. And then we realized that some of that was just too out of everyday life, people's personal experiences, and the one common denominator that everybody has is their health, their personal health, the health of their families, the health of their communities. There's some really interesting work being done now looking at the whole concept of conservation biology. Conservation biology many, many years ago was about trying to preserve parts of the planet so they would be absolutely pristine, true wilderness areas, untouched by human beings. And I think now what we're realizing is there is no part of the planet that is untouched by human beings. You don't have to have physically been there to have had the climate warm up, the glaciers melt, the tundra and permafrost melt, the pollutants get everywhere. And so we have to take a whole new approach now and assume that man has already impacted every aspect of the environment, and we have to get in there and stop what's wrong and promote what's right. And again, as Jay said, that has to be based on the best available science. And so if we were going to urge our current political leaders to take a position, we would be one of taking position of gathering as much input as they possibly can and operating off facts.
Today we are speaking with two emergency physicians. Dr. Paul Auerbach is family professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine, and Dr. Jay Lemery is associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. And they have written a new book called Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. And they argue that we need to start focusing on this issue more, how climate change is putting our health in danger. It's already happening. And what do we need to do about it? And if you have any questions for Dr. Jay Lemery or Dr. Paul Auerbach, we'd love to hear from you. If you have experienced any changes from the fires, asthma, from just the air that you breathe, if you've noticed any differences, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you work in the field of public health, you can give us a call or email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's spend some time talking about clean water. Unfortunately, we've been wanting to do a show about Flint to check in there to find out what is happening. And sadly, it's shocking, but people are still drinking bottled water there. And in your book, Enviromedics, you write that more than 1.6 billion people worldwide do not have access to clean water. 2.6 billion people don't have access to sanitation. And 1.4 billion people live in areas where water use exceeds replenishment. Paul, can you talk about what concerns you most about water?
I would say that water is arguably our most precious resource right now, and in particular, it would be clean, unpolluted water. So both potable water for drinking, which in areas of drought or areas where there's not sufficient water disinfection, will be a precious commodity, and also the preservation of natural environmental sources of water, like the oceans and other areas that can be used for reasonable food production and to preserve protein sources for everybody. So there are many, many aspects to water. There are things that we don't know yet. There's a fascinating article in this week's, I think it's this week's, Journal of the American Medical Association, where someone has written about what the hazards are of fracking, and that we don't know yet how pumping water containing acid and surfactants and other chemicals into the ground and then pulling all that out and potentially storing it underground where it can leach into drinking supplies, what the impact of that might be. Now, I'm not saying that there is a bad impact, but because the point of the article was we just need to consider every aspect of what we're doing that will impact our water supply and make sure that we're not further contaminating it.
Yeah, we've done a lot of shows about fracking and talked about all of the new science coming out around that. What would you add, Jay? What concerns you the most about water?
Yeah, I mean, you think about water security and climate change. You think about, one, that, you know, droughts and heat, you know, desiccate known water sources, right? So you've got more people competing for limited water. But then you think about extreme weather events. And I use the phrase, my parasitology professor in medical school talked about the fecal veneer, which was this fine layer of veneer that covered everything. And it's the idea that, you know, where we, some places it's thicker than others, but where we eat and drink and where we grow our food and where we go to the bathroom, you know, our sewer infrastructure, they're all sort of separate. But with extreme downpours and flooding, all those get mixed. So not only does it contaminate water supply, but also now we know there's spikes in infectious diarrhea, which causes incredible morbidity and mortality throughout the world, particularly in children and, you know, vulnerable people. So it's a real risk. So, you know, water security is one of the big things, you know, the top of the list when it comes to threats from climate change.
You did a lot of research for this book. What struck you the most when you read about what's to come? You've got a section called Water Wars, and you write that given that 60% of the world's population lives in water basins shared by two or more nations, many historians, scientists, and political experts speculate that the 21st century will be one of worldwide conflicts over water. When you were doing the research, Paul, what really stood out for you specifically on this issue?
I think you've summarized it pretty well. What stood out for me is that it's something that stands out all the time, which is that instead of banding together to solve problems like this represents, people get into conflict over problems and seek to dominate one another. I don't think this is too Pollyannish, but if we took the same resources that we spent to compete and to conquer and to dominate populations when we have shortages and adverse situations, and we put that into collaboration and building resources and mitigating the fundamental causes, then a lot of these problems would go away. So what strikes me is the lack of awareness, for number one, and then the lack of collaboration to solve these problems. And it has to occur at local, regional, national levels if we're going to have a prayer to have it occur at international levels.
Yeah, we just did a show last week, Jay, with Gar Smith, who wrote a book about perpetual war. And he said when you look at the military budget, a number of researchers say that if you take 15% of that budget, you could tackle these issues around the globe.
Well, for sure. I mean, that's the essence of, you know, priorities, right? Government priorities and, you know, public health preventative infrastructure and public health expenditures, right? That's been a perpetual issue. And again, you know, I think that's up to the population and the politicians, but we would certainly advocate for more energy and more budget appropriation to these issues. I mean, it's I think if nothing else, we're making the case that climate change will dwarf a lot of these other things, and that will the amount of pain and suffering that we can avoid from a little bit of prevention is well worth it.
We have an email from Trish who says, regarding your guest statement about how climate change makes us feel hopeless, one thing we can do is check out the Citizens Climate Lobby. It's a volunteer organization that enables everyday citizens to find the political will to work towards climate change on the national level. While it seems that there might not be any hope, CCL is working with a bipartisan group in the House called the Climate Solutions Caucus. There's 30 Dems and 30 Republicans committed to working together on climate change. Well, thank you for that email. Email Trish, and you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're continuing our One Planet series by speaking with Drs. Paul Auerbach and Dr. Jay Lemery. They're emergency physicians, and they wrote a new book called Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. You can join us at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. So we talked about water. Let's talk a little bit about droughts. We had horrible droughts in California over the last couple of years. It'll be interesting now that we're heading into winter to see what happens in the coming months. But you write that the health effects of drought accumulate over time beyond acute starvation are mostly indirect, meaning that drought optimizes conditions for other health threats like infectious diseases or chronic nutrition. Paul, what do we need to know about droughts and how that affects human health?
In terms of human health, the drought is both a direct impact on human health. So if you're starved for water and you're dehydrated, you're going to be quite sick. And it's also another one of those threat multipliers, because if you can't grow crops, if you can't earn a livelihood, if you're forced to migrate, that's the worst possible situation. And if what we're doing to the climate is causing droughts, that is a very bad situation. On the local level, in the state of California, we can't have a false sense of security because we had one terrific winter with a lot of snowpack. The water, most of that water is going to melt off and go into the ocean. Shasta is going to be full again, and some of the other lakes will appear full, but what isn't being replenished and what takes years to be replenished are the aquifers that are under the ground, where the water has to get down in there. So if the runoff went out to the ocean, that's good, but it doesn't replenish the water supply. So we're by no means out of the woods on the drought situation in California yet.
Right. And then you also write about what's going on around the world in Tanzania and Mozambique, droughts were associated with outbreaks of Kanzo. This is a neurological disease that causes irreversible paralysis. You also write about water scarcity contributing to inadequately processing cassava, which is a staple food that has to be soaked in water for 3 or 4 days to safely rid the residual flour of neurotoxic, is it cyanogens? Cyanogens? I'm not sure.
Cyanotoxins?
Thank you. You have so many other examples in here. In China, a drought caused selenium to enter the food system, which afflicted local communities with hair and nail loss and skin lesions. Jay, I mean, there's so many examples about how droughts are affecting public health.
Yeah, this is all about food insecurity. There's water, you know, there's kind of two ways to think about this, water insecurity, but also food insecurity. And droughts disrupt normal nutritious food, you know, we call it from farm to table, anywhere along those lines, you can get a perturbation in the food chain. You know, people begin to cut corners. They eat less nutritious foods. They eat food of a certain type. They cut corners on their food processing, which was some of these things that you just referred to. They end up eating, processed unhealthy foods, which can give rise to what we call the non-communicable diseases, you know, so heart disease, diabetes, and so forth. So those are, drought really plays into a larger thing of food insecurity, where you're changing the ecosystem, so your reliable food supply now becomes very tenuous. The other thing about drought is that it can add to civil strife, right? So places with poor governance or civil strife that pre-exists can exacerbate that. And one of the most frequently cited things is, you know, in the Levant, you know, so Lebanon and Syria, the crisis there was thought to have been contributed to one of the worst droughts in over 900 years. You know, people left the countryside and moved into the cities, sort of stoking the civil unrest there.
And lack of drinking water, this is Paul again, lack of drinking water is a cause for panic. Jay and I have both done disaster response to earthquake situations, and a question that I'm frequently asked is, how do you suffer if you're an earthquake victim? The immediate panic beyond trauma is lack of access to water. You really can only go about 3 days without water, 3 to 4 days, and then you're in big trouble. So without access to potable drinking water, the situation gets very bad very quickly.
We have a Facebook message from Penelope saying we need to spend more time talking about a plant-based diet, eating less meat because agriculture uses so much water here in the United States, but also around the world. Paul, what are your thoughts on that? A lot of scientists and environmentalists are finally starting to tackle this issue.
I think it speaks to a bigger issue. I'm not going to pretend that I'm the world's expert on all of these things, because remember, I'm a doctor and not a climate scientist. But I will speak to the issue of fully understanding all of the energy equations for both the common and uncommon situations we have. So it's important to know how much energy is actually consumed and how much natural resource is consumed to generate electricity, to grow food by various methods, to stay warm, to stay fed, because there'll always be trade-offs. And some of the situations that we may take to be intuitively obvious may not be true. And so that's why we're saying that it is a very complicated world and a lot of interrelationships, and we need to understand it as best we possibly can so that we can make the best decisions. And this would fall into that category, and I think it's a very appropriate comment.
Yes, thank you, Penelope. We're almost out of time, but let's go quickly to Greg. Hi, Greg. Do we have Greg? Do we know what Greg's question was? No. Okay. Sorry, Greg. We're almost out of time. I got to say, Paul and Jay, I mean, we do shows about this stuff all the time, but it's really daunting. I'm so glad you wrote this book. It's so important, but the stats are really daunting. As emergency physicians who care so deeply about these issues, we know where we're going, but what are your thoughts about, I mean, we know what changes we need to make, but given who, you know, the climate deniers in the White House, it's going to be tough. The next 4 years is going to be really tough. So in the meantime, Paul, what can people do?
I'm going to draw an analogy to what I did back when emergency medicine was a new specialty and there were naysayers. So the equivalent of the climate deniers. I decided then that the best thing I could do was to be the best emergency physician I could, and that would demonstrate why we were necessary. And while I'd like to battle all the climate deniers, I would rather do good work. I'd rather put the science out there. I'd rather put books like this out there. I'd like to inspire people that are a lot brighter than I am and have more energy, and that's how I intend to approach this issue. Of course, I'll talk to people who want my opinion, but I really want to engage as many people as I can. And I'd like to mention, if it's okay, that the book is available throughout the Bay Area at Books Inc. now for those people who are interested.
Yes, thank you. Support independent bookstores. Jay, we have about a minute. What would you add?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Paul. I think rather than getting into to fights with people who may not, you know, may not bring an honest fight to the table, is to shine a, you know, take a big flashlight and shine it on the truth. And then this is what we do. We're scientists at heart. That's what physicians are. And by bringing forth the best science, let it speak for itself. And then, you know, history has shown time and time again that the truth emerges. The truth wins.
Yeah, let's.
I think it's just, do we have the time? But, you know, good people are fighting this fight. So if nothing else, I think, you know, we can inspire those to say, hey, what could a doctor do that a climate scientist or a politician can't do? And this is something, and everyone has a world to contribute. And, you know, hopefully this will create some activism out there, and just even within one's own constituency, to talk about this and how important it is.
Dr. Jay Lemery and Dr. Paul Auerbach are emergency physicians, and they're out with a new book called Enviromedics, The Impact of Climate Change on Human Health. And you can find it at the independent bookstore Books, Inc. throughout the Bay Area. Jay and Paul, thank you so much for your work. We'd love to have you back, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank Jay for letting me participate in this with him.
All right. Well, we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much. Your call is produced here at KALW, and you can find out more about today's show and Your Call's One Planet series at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.